Welcome to Open for Business, the Gallatin Valley's only local business and consumer talk show featuring Tom Eaglehoff, the Man Entrepreneur magazine radio called the leading authority in the United States for doing business in small towns. Here he is, speaker, author, small business consultant, and Mrs. Eaglehoff's favorite son, Tom Eaglehoff.
All right, welcome back. Thank you, everyone. 69 degrees outside. It's Saturday, May 11th, and we'd like to wish everybody a happy Mother's Day tomorrow. All you moms, for all the great stuff you do, happy Mother's Day going out to you. And also, coming up on Tuesday, May 14th, I'll be over at Livingston. I'll be at the Best Western Yellowstone Inn, 9 to 11:30. I'm going to be doing a seminar over there on customer service. If you'd like to be involved in that, contact the Chamber of Commerce over there in Livingston. And everyone in attendance will get a free copy of my book, 260-page book, The Small Town Advertising Handbook, How to Say More and Spend Less. So we're happy to do that for you. We want to talk about global warming today. We've got Norm Rogers on the phone. He's a physicist, a retired computer entrepreneur, volunteer with the senior policy advisor at Heartland Institute. He's a member of the American Geophysical Union and the American Meteorological Society. Easy for me to say. And his website, if you want to take a look over there, is climateviews.com. So, Norm, thanks for coming. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
Yeah. I wanted to chat with you. You sent me a couple of interesting articles on climate change, global warming, pick your adjective, I guess. But I wanted to talk about an article that you sent me from Dr. Spencer in Alabama, isn't it? Is he in Alabama?
My American Thinker article on
right.
Dr. Spencer.
Yeah. One of the things that you talked about in there that I think would maybe put this in perspective for the listeners out there is something called climate sensitivity. Can you maybe expound on that a little bit and tell
sure.
us what that is, and then we'll before we go there, let's tell the folks a little bit about yourself, your background, and where you came from, and how you got interested in the climate
sure.
debate at all.
Well, Tom, I studied physics in college. I spent 3 years in graduate school doing that. I was pursuing a PhD, but I dropped out of that and went into computers. And eventually I started a company in California and pursued that for 25 years. And back in 2005, I sold it and retired and was looking for something to occupy my time. So I started studying global warming. And that's what I've been doing for the last 7 or 8 years, most of my time. I've written a lot of articles about it. And that's pretty much my story.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's move on to climate sensitivity. What are we talking about for the benefit of the listeners
sure.
when we talk about climate sensitivity?
Well, climate sensitivity is it's a number, and it's what the most important thing about global warming. Formally, what it is they say, well, if you double the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, how much will the average temperature of the Earth increase? And the people who are real believers in global warming and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they say, well, doubling carbon dioxide will increase the temperature of the Earth by 3 degrees. But it's very difficult for them to figure out what this climate sensitivity really is. It's under dispute. The way the people who are pushing global warming do it is they have these very complicated computer models. These computer models are among the most complicated and biggest computer programs ever written. And different models have been written at about 20 different laboratories around the world. They've actually spent billions of dollars on this. And those models all disagree with each other about what climate sensitivity is. So some of the models say 2 degrees, some say 4 degrees. So they said, well, the models say 2 degrees or 4 degrees, so we'll just average it out and say it must be 3 degrees. But it's really scientifically a very vague sort of way of doing this because the models aren't very good. They don't mimic the Earth's climate very well. Now, Dr. Spencer down at the University of Alabama devised another method of measuring climate science sensitivity. It involves analyzing data from satellites. There's satellites up there that measure the temperature of the Earth, and they measure the temperature of the whole Earth, and they do that by looking at microwave radiation coming off of oxygen molecules that varies with temperature. And there are other satellites that measure the amount of radiation reaching the Earth and escaping from the Earth. Dr. Spencer took that information and devised a new theory of climate sensitivity, and his theory suggests that climate sensitivity is much, much less than the people who are advocating global warming, which we usually call warmest, say. He thinks it's probably less than a half degree if you double CO2. So that's what climate sensitivity is. I think the important point is that when people run around saying that all the science is settled, everyone agrees, it's just not true. There's a lot of controversy, and there's a very embarrassing thing that's been going on. That is, the Earth hasn't warmed since 1998. You know, when they devised this theory back in the 70s and 80s, the Earth was going through a warming spell, so it kind of matched up with their theory. The Earth stopped warming and hasn't warmed now for 16 years, and so they started to change their tune and call it climate change or extreme weather rather than calling it global warming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because as I said earlier, if you're listening to me earlier, I was talking about you cover both ways there. If it cools, it's still the same problem, isn't it? That, you know, vegetation would not react well, animal life would not react well to cooling as just the opposite of global warming. So let's take a quick phone call, Norm, if you wouldn't mind. Caller, you are on the air with Norm Rogers. What's your name? What's up?
Bob Vandervoort.
Hey, Bob, how you doing? Bob is, yeah, Bob, for benefit of you, Norman, Bob is my oil and gas guy that I have on from time to time. And, of course, we have a big oil boom going on up here in our area, as you are well aware of. So I just wanted to introduce him and to the listeners. So, Bob, what do you got?
Well, I've been responding to your Facebook postings, and it seems to be a total coincidence, which, you know, I basically don't think there are such things as coincidences, that this global warming thing all of a sudden hit 400 right on the money, May 9th, when all this other stuff was going on in the world. And one of your Facebook friends said, well, we should make this political. Well, Al Gore made it political.
Yeah, well, what they're referring to is that the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere hit 400 parts per million.
So where do you put this meter? You put it right next to the biggest volcano on the island of Hawaii, Honolulu. Guess what you're going to get?
Well, it's a dead volcano, okay?
Well, okay. I'm not living next to it. I'm living in Montana. It's been damn cold here.
You know, a wonderful thing about carbon dioxide is that it's food for plants. Plants breathe in carbon dioxide, and they use the carbon to create their tissue and their wood and sugar and fruit and everything else. And more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere makes plants grow quicker. In fact, a lot of greenhouses, they put carbon dioxide generators in them.
Yeah, that
is true. Okay, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to point out that we've seen articles to that effect coming out that Brazil is greener than it has been in past years, where a lot of vegetation was being cleared and people were worried about what's that going to do to the warming effect. So if we can get trees more efficient, then it's sort of like the assembly line for the car. So go ahead, Bob.
Well, there's a huge forest fire that's never been put out. It's in Canada, in the Vancouver area. And it's putting out more carbon dioxide than any of the carbon that's being put out by exploring for oil sand. So shouldn't we make the Canadians put that out before they produce any more oil sands? And maybe we can even out the... Is that true?
I don't know. I haven't heard about that fire, but that sounds like a good cause. I mean, I'm surprised the environmentalists haven't mentioned that.
Well, I have a guy from Vancouver who's on with me the first Saturday of every month, who grew up here and went to school here, but lives in Canada now. So we go back and forth about what's going on in Canada. So I'll have to make a note, and I'll ask him about it next time we chat, see if that's a real deal. Hey, thanks for the call, Bob.
Okay, there's a coal-powered energy or electrical power plant being built in China every other day.
Yeah.
And the coal is going to come from Montana. So unless we get other countries to join in the whatever that accord was in.
Yeah, the Kyoto
Accord.
Yeah.
All right, I'll let you go.
All right, thanks Bob. All right, thanks for the call. Yeah, the Kyoto Accord was another thing that everybody was pushing far pretty hard, but it exempted China and India, is my understanding.
Yeah, it was very political. Another very bad thing about the Kyoto Accord is that, you know, it gives credit to people for using windmills or solar power to generate electricity because it doesn't give any CO2. But it doesn't give any credit to people for setting up a nuclear power plant, which also doesn't generate any CO2. And the only reason they don't give credit to nuclear is because the environmental groups that supported the Kyoto Accord, it would be embarrassing for them because back in the 70s and 80s, they destroyed nuclear power.
Yeah, it got to the point where it wasn't so much that putting up a power plant was beyond reach of monetarily, but there were so many hoops you had to jump through to get one made, and the liability insurance and everything else was just off the charts for it.
Yeah. It's just a matter of strangling an industry with regulations.
Yeah, well, that's what we were thinking about now. France, I believe, don't they run almost all of their electricity off
They're 80% nuclear power, and they also export a lot of power to these other countries.
So let's move in. Let's maybe move on to some other topics here. And again, Bob, I want to thank you for coming in on a Saturday, but we appreciate it. Sometimes it's not easy to get guests on a weekend, so we really appreciate you taking the time. Let's talk about the main methods of generating electricity, because there's several, and let's maybe go through those and what are the current methods used right now, and what information do you have on those?
Sure. Well, coal is the most important one, and right now it's about 40% of our electricity. It used to be 50%. Of course, we have tremendous amount of coal, enough coal to last for hundreds of years. The second most important method is natural gas, and that's becoming more popular because the price of natural gas has declined radically ever since they started fracking.
Do you think the Northeast, which has for years has relied on heating oil, are we going to see a large influx of natural gas in that part of the United States, do you think?
I would think so, since they actually have the shale deposits there that they can get the gas out of. I know in Pennsylvania they're doing a lot of gas production.
Yeah, New York, they won't let them. I don't think you can put a golf tee in the ground without a permit.
Yeah, they've prohibited the fracking in New York.
Yeah.
I think the people there are getting tired of the cost of heating oil, for sure.
Well, I would think so. Maybe we should put Bloomberg on the case. Hey, that natural gas is going to burn a heck of a lot cleaner than the coal or the heating oil.
Yeah, it's a wonderful fuel, and natural gas can be used for automobiles, too. The third method of is 20% of our power comes from nuclear generation. And these are all nuclear plants that were built back in the 70s and 80s. And some of them are coming to the end of their life. They've been out there for 40, 50 years. And then we got hydroelectric, which I know is important up in Montana and Washington and Idaho. That's about 6% of our electricity. And, of course, wind, which the environmentalists love so much, is right now 2%.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we see more hydroelectric? It seems like that would be a no-brainer. I realize you got to figure out a way to get boats around it, but, you know, it seems like you could put up some kind of a thing halfway across the Mississippi and, you know, still run barges back and forth.
Well, you really need mountains to have good hydroelectric. You need to have
the melting and the flow of the water.
A lot of water and a good drop.
Yeah.
And of course that's what you have in the Columbia River and the Colorado River.
Right.
But you also have to remember now that our friends, the environmentalists, are opposed to all dams now.
Yeah.
So there's not going to be too much more hydro.
Let's take another phone call. 522-TALK is the number if you'd like to be on the air. If you're outside of Montana, 406 is the area code, 406-522-TALK. Caller, thanks for waiting. You're on the air with Norm Rogers. What's your name? What's up?
Yeah, hi, guys. It's Kevin.
Hey, Kevin. How you doing?
Good, good. You know, I mean, I think the greater scope of this is that, you know, the environmentalists, but, you know, the environmentalists are being used. I mean, sometimes it might be, you know, Russia. Russia is one of the big opponents of our natural gas because they have natural gas, too. And so they're pumping a lot of money into the negative advertising of the natural gas here in this country, because it behooves them that if we don't get into, you know, for us not to be in the natural gas, because then people will buy their natural gas. So there's a lot of players in this. You know, maybe oil companies who don't want, you know, natural gas taking over gasoline. And so, you know, maybe there's oil companies who are pressuring people. you know, the whole environmentalist thing is about control and money. I mean, you guys were talking earlier about the forest fire, you know, or someone called in about a forest fire with CO2 burning. You know, the reason why the Greenies aren't up in the air about that is because that doesn't advance their agenda about shutting down the West and shutting down production.
I'd like to give you a very concrete example of that.
Yeah.
Back around, you know, the Sierra Club has had a campaign against coal for a long time.
Right.
Back around 2009, I think, the natural gas industry gave the Sierra Club $25 million to promote their campaign against coal because the natural gas industry wanted to, you know, move into the electricity generation area.
Okay.
But the Sierra Club turned on them, and now they're attacking fracking, which
right.
is the natural gas.
Right, absolutely. and then they promote stuff like solar panels, and the solar panels pollute the planet so much more than anything that you could think of. All the chemicals that go into making each of those solar cells, and all that gets dumped into the environment. But, you know, if it's made in China, I guess we don't see it, so it's out of sight, out of mind.
Well, I don't know about the chemical bit, but solar is a joke, okay? It's so expensive. It's just
right.
not even remotely competitive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and isn't it true that, I mean, CO2, you know, I'm driving around my truck, so I don't have these figures, but I did a show on this a while ago. CO2 is like 5% of the greenhouse gases anyways in the atmosphere. So they're trying to block something that is such a small percentage of what's in the atmosphere and what is made up of quote-unquote greenhouse gases anyways. So, I mean, it's a total fictitious, made-up attack to control and limit power to a certain few. And that's what it is. And the Greenies are in bed as much as, you know, any kind of maybe giant corporation that stands to benefit one way or the other, or a country like Russia. It, you know, to me, it just seems like it's all about power and money. And they have us, you know, bickering back and forth while, you know, they basically kind of control the markets the way they want to do it.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call. Okay, thank you.
All right, take care. All right, yeah, go ahead, Norm.
Yeah, I don't go for the extreme conspiracy theories. I mean, the people who believe in global warming, most of them are sincere.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's helped along by the fact that sometimes it benefits them financially, but most of them are sincere about it.
Yeah.
It's just that they exaggerate their level of scientific knowledge.
Well, one thing that I've always wondered about, Norm, and maybe you can comment on this, back in the 1800s here in Montana when you know, we were getting started as a nation, I guess, in this part of the world. You know, people reported there'd be buffalo and elk and, you know, you name it, as far as the eye could see. And it seems like that would be putting out the same emissions as L.A. or, you know, Chicago or somewhere like that. Is that, has anybody looked at that, what before fossil fuels?
Well, what they would say is that the elk may put out emissions, but it was recycled. In other words, when the elk died, they would decay and turn into carbon dioxide, and then the plants would absorb the carbon dioxide, and mm-hmm. new generation of elk would eat the plants.
Oh, okay.
The difference is that when you take coal or natural gas or oil, that's a fossil fuel that was made from living matter millions of years ago, and so we're adding new CO2 to the atmosphere. But as I said, CO2 is very beneficial to crops and plants and so forth.
Okay. We got about 2 minutes left here. When we come back, Norm, I'd like to talk a little bit about alternative fuels, the various alternative fuels that are available on the horizon. We talked a little bit about some of, you know, nuclear and obviously the natural gas, which we have a lot of that here in Montana as well. So let's finish up the hour here. We'll take one more phone call. Caller, you are on the air with Norm Rogers. What's your name? What's up?
This is Vinny. And Norm, you're not one of those people that really believes the myth from 1876 of fossil fuel, do you? That was a canard that was put out by the Rockefellers at a scientific conference in Geneva. Well, what we know about abiotic fuel right now, fossil fuel was the carbon credit, the global warming of its day. We have abiotic oil, and we know it right now.
You're saying that oil and gas doesn't come from fossils?
It doesn't come from ancient forests. No, we've proven that with the Kolot wells in Sakhalin Island, 40,000-foot deep granite wells that the Russians have drilled, and there's no possibility that those had ever been old ancient forests. There's something down inside the earth that's creating oil, some organism that when it's fed hydro and when it's fed carbon, it emits oil and gas.
Well, if you go into a coal mine and look at the coal, I mean, you can
coal
find fossils in there.
I'm saying oil is not a fossil fuel. I didn't say coal was. Coal is a top level. That's a different story. Coal is different, but oil and gas are not fossil. Abiotic oil, look it up. Check out the...
Well, I've heard of it before, but I think that's a controversial position you're taking.
Well, fossil fuels was proposed by the Rockefellers to create the synthetic illusion that there's a shortage of this oil. It was in their best interest, just like with the diamond, create artificial shortage.
Gotta go, Vinny. I'm up against the clock. All righty, thanks for the call. All right, Norm, you're going to hang around with us. When we come back, we're going to be out for about 4 minutes, 10 seconds here coming up. We want to talk more with Norm Rogers. Norm is he's a physicist. He's a retired computer entrepreneur, volunteer senior policy advisor at the Heartland Institute. He's a member of the American Geophysical Union and the American Meteorological Society, and his website is climateviews.com, climateviews.com. We'll be right back with more from Norm. This is News Radio AM 1450 KMMS in Bozeman, 1340 KPRK in Livingston, and on the World Wide Web at Find Computers Everywhere all around the world, KMMSAM.com. 70 degrees, open for business. We'll be right back right after this.
Let's get back to Open for Business on News Radio AM 1450 KMMS Bozeman. Lines are open at 522-TALK. That's 522-8255. Here he is. He's big, he's bad, and he's open for business, Tom Eaglehoff.
All right, thank you, Dan. Welcome back, everyone. 70 degrees outside. It's Saturday, May 11th. Happy Mother's Day tomorrow to all the great moms out there. 25 minutes till the top of the hour. We're talking about global warming, climate change. You know, pick your adjective. We're talking with Norm Rogers, who is a physicist. He's a retired computer entrepreneur, a volunteer senior policy advisor at the Heartland Institute, a member of the American Geophysical Union and the American Meteorological Society. I'm going to get that right some sooner or later. And his website is climateviews.com. So, Norm, thanks for hanging around with us for a little longer.
Glad to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about... one of the things, of course, is electricity, and that's one of the, you know, getting off the fossil fuels a little bit, because I wanted to talk a little bit about alternative energies. The other situation we have is generating electricity. So how is the cost of different methods of generating electricity computed and compared between wind and solar and hydroelectric and all of those?
Sure. Well, let's leave solar power kind of out of it, because solar power is not really practical at all. Wind power, it's a little different than some of the other types of ways of generating electricity, like using coal or natural gas, because wind power doesn't require any fuel. So all the cost is what you call capital cost. It's the cost to build the setup in the first place, and a little bit of cost to maintain it. And wind power, it only works when the wind is blowing, and the wind is kind of erratic. So on the average, wind power installations only generate about 25% of the maximum amount of power they could theoretically generate if the wind was perfect all the time. Wind power is completely subsidized by the government. It wouldn't be even remotely competitive if it weren't for what's called a production tax credit, which is a 2.3 cents a kilowatt hour that the government gives the wind generators for every kilowatt hour of electricity they generate. That covers about 30% of the cost of setting up a wind farm. Now, another thing that helps the wind farm guys is what's called the renewable energy portfolios. In a lot of states, the wind lobbyists have succeeded in convincing the legislatures to pass a law saying that 15% of the energy should come from renewable sources. There's such a law in Montana, I looked it up. And that gives a kind of guaranteed market to the people who are doing wind energy. You know, you have a lot of hydro energy in Montana, but the law in Montana says that can't count hydro as renewable unless it was built after 2005. So that way the wind energy stacked the deck in their favor.
Was that the reason it was set up as, I don't understand how hydroelectric can't be producing before 2005. What was it producing before that? Grapefruits?
Yeah. No, they just didn't want it competing with the wind guys. And then you have the funny situation that in the Northwest, at certain times of the year, there's so much water due to the spring rains and the runoff that they have a surplus of power, which they can't really get rid of because there's not enough power lines to take it someplace that could sell it.
And you can't store it for any length of time.
Right, because the waters could overflow the dam. So in that situation, you get into competition between the hydro guys and the wind guys. And what the wind guys do then is they start paying people to take the electricity. And in other words, they have a negative charge for the electricity. And the reason they do that is because they're after that 2.3 cents a kilowatt hour from the federal government. If they can't get someone to take their electricity, they can't get that 2.3 cents. So you get the ridiculous situation of the wind energy guys trying to pay people to use up their power.
I know we can't do it today, but is it possible to power the country with wind and solar, assuming that windmills become way more efficient and solar instead of being the solar panel instead of being the size of a Buick is the size of a dime? Is that possible somewhere down the road, or is wind and solar always going to be something that's going to offset your electric bill? You know, putting a solar panel on my roof might cut my hot water costs by 25% or something a year.
Well, you know, it's probably possible to make houses out of hard candy, but yeah. It's not really practical.
Is it practical to do it? Yeah, well, that's what I'm getting at. You know, an analogy I always use, Bob, is that all of these energies have to go through an evolutionary process. Whatever energy we end up with is going to, I mean, you look at the telephone, you look at television, you look at all the advances we've made. You know, Edison didn't, or rather, Alexander Graham Bell didn't tell Watson, okay, now we got the talking down. We'll work on texting tomorrow. I don't think that happened quite that way. But the other analogy is that if we wanted to, the horse and the car existed simultaneously for over 50 years. If we wanted to increase the evolution of the automobile, we should have just shot all the horses, and then we'd be forced to make a better car. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't work that way.
Well, I think the problem is that there's such a thing as a mature technology that's not improving very fast. And wind energy is actually a pretty mature technology. It's highly developed. I don't see that there's going to be a lot of improvements in wind energy. Solar energy is pretty much in the same boat. There may be some improvements in the solar panels, but the interesting thing is even if the solar panels cost absolutely nothing, solar would still not be competitive because there's so much money in all the posts and power lines and everything to provide the infrastructure for the solar panels.
Well, I always thought that there would be a day when electricity would be broadcast to your house, much like this radio signal is.
Well, there is a proposal to do that.
Yeah.
They want to put satellites up in the sky. And of course, solar energy works much better in space because the sun's always shining. And there's no cloud cover.
Other interference.
And then they want to beam the energy down with microwaves. Considering the cost of getting things into space, it's probably not practical.
Yeah, right. Well, at least not right now. And this is what I was talking about earlier, is that you got six billion people on the planet, and whoever comes up with this alternative energy is going to make a lot of money. And, you know, the old school thought might be that, well, these other companies are going to jump in their way. Well, they might, but I think you're going to see more people jump on board than try to stop the trade.
Well, there is a great source of alternative energy, which is not that mature technology, and that's nuclear. There are people working right now on new types of nuclear plants that can be manufactured in factories buried underground, smaller scale, and there may be a great future in this.
Yeah. Well, we run submarines on it.
Yes, and we run our aircraft carriers on it.
Yeah. So it seems like, again, is it, because I know in what's the place in Utah where they were worried about, what do I do with all the nuclear waste? And that seems to be the crux of nuclear, is what do you do with the leftover material?
Yeah, of course, there is the possibility of burning up the nuclear waste in reactors.
Yeah.
Because
But won't that pollute the CO2?
No, there's no CO2 coming from the nuclear reactors.
Well, I meant when you burn it.
No, they burn it by radioactive.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, there you go.
It's a radioactive, it's a nuclear fuel.
All right. So, No, I had a picture of a couple guys in suits with flamethrowers out there doing a big pile.
Nope, don't. I shouldn't have used the word burn. They can. The waste can be used as the waste generates a lot of heat because it's got radioactive materials in it, and in principle, it could be burned up in another type of reactor.
Yeah.
That technology's been kind of stalled.
Yeah.
There's a lot of possibilities there. The real problem with nuclear is political, and that there's a segment of kind of hysterical people that don't like nuclear. They're scared of it, and there's been a lot of propaganda put out about it.
Well, Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, are the two biggies, obviously, that scare people.
Yeah.
No one
died at Three Mile Island, and 13 people died at Chernobyl.
Yeah.
Every year, 5,000 people were killed mining coal.
Yeah. Well, and we've all seen the China Syndrome movie, so we're done with nuclear. So that's just over. So let's go back to the wind farms, because you were mentioning those earlier. We've got one up here at Judith Gap, and there's a few others obviously around the country. There's several up in New York where I spoke a few years ago at one of the colleges up there. But how long do these wind farms last, and how do they compare with other methods of power generation?
The turbines are manufacturers specify them to have a lifetime of 20 years. But there's an article that came out recently that said a lot of them are dropping out after 12, 15 years. Now, the significant thing is the federal subsidy drops after 10 years. So I think it's probably a safe bet that every 15 to 20 years, if you want to keep going with wind power, you have to build and, upgrade them or replace them.
Okay.
Now, if you go and Google wind turbine graveyards, you'll find dozens of pictures of graveyards of old turbines that were built in the 70s and 80s and are still sitting around with broken blades and falling down towers and everything. Mm-hmm. They're all over the place.
Well, I know at one time, I guess Boone Pickens was big on wind and solar and whatever, and he kind of went away from that after I guess he got the education about it and the return on investment. I don't know.
Well, the return on investment is good if you're getting the money from Washington.
Well, yeah, I guess.
And you got the legislatures writing laws that stack the price in favor of the wind guys.
Well, will there be a time that solar and wind is ever justified that I assume these aren't going to go away. These technologies aren't going to leave.
Well,
but
I mean, if you've ever seen these emergency phones, beside some highways, the little solar panel on that's a great application of solar energy because it's expensive to run a power line out there. There is a place, I know a few places where I think wind power has a rightful position. I went on vacation in Newfoundland and I saw them building some big wind turbines there. And I found out they were generating their electricity by burning oil. Now, oil is a very, very expensive fuel.
Yeah.
And to use it to burn electricity is just terribly expensive. And they said that every time the wind turbine generated some electricity and it slowed down the burning of oil, it paid for itself. So, and they said they figured they could put about 6% of their power from wind. You can't put too much wind in the system because if the wind stops blowing, the whole system will collapse. Mm-hmm. That did happen in Texas where they had a blackout due to a sudden drop in the wind. Basically, if you have a lot of wind power, you have wind power in your system, you have to have some what is called spinning capacity to take over if the wind slows down.
Right.
So that means they have a big plant with a generator spinning around. If the wind dies down, they start feeding more fuel into that generator to take over the load. So they have to have backup plants, and that's part of the, they don't necessarily factor that into the cost of the wind, but that is there. And just have a little bit of wind, you can kind of gloss it over. If you ever tried to really generate 15 or 20% of your energy from wind, the backup plants would be a major, major problem.
One of the other buzzwords that we hear all the time, well, at least I do from time to time, are something called energy portfolios. So for the benefit of our listeners, can you kind of give us an overview of what are renewable energy portfolios?
Well, basically, that's laws that have been passed in about half the states saying that by some target date, would be it 2015 or 2020, some percentage of the electricity is supposed to come from renewable energy. Renewable energy is usually defined to be wind and solar. And those laws were put in there under false pretenses. The lobbyists for the wind energy, the American Wind Energy Association, they go around saying that wind is competitive and economical and really good for the environment, all this kind of stuff. And I guess, frankly, naive legislators pass these laws. And what the result is that everyone ends up paying more for electricity. It's kind of like a hidden way of siphoning money away from people into the people promoting wind farms.
Let's take a phone call. 522-TALK is the number, 406 area code if you're outside of Montana. Call, you are on the air. What's your name? What's up?
Hey, my name is Joe, and I was wondering about recycling old motor oil and how about old tires and things like that. Certainly there's a petroleum component to that, don't you think?
Yeah, and there are power plants that burn that stuff.
Yeah, up here we have one that was working with trying to get a tire burning a Trident, I think here. A manufacturing company here was trying to do that, and they had all the environmental studies of what it's going to produce and what's going to happen with the waste and all kinds of things. So it is being done around, certainly.
Okay. Well, I just didn't know how efficient or how much scrubbing it required, or does it add up, basically?
I think it's a good way to get rid of old tires.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. better than breeding mosquitoes with them, huh?
Well, I mean, hey, we're trying.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So why not? Okay. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, hey, thanks for the call. No, I appreciate it. Yeah, the recycling has kind of taken a few hits in recent years as well. We've got artificial oil, or synthetic oil, I should say, not artificial, but those things are going around. Norm, another thing, we talked about subsidizing wind energy and some of these clean energies, but doesn't the government also, the oil companies certainly get some subsidies, do they not?
That's mostly BS. I had to laugh when I was reading a publication put out by the Environmental Department in the Montana state government. They were trying to demonstrate that coal was getting a subsidy. And in Montana, there's a tax on coal.
We have the coal tax we put aside for who knows what.
And that tax is 15% on high quality coal, 10% on lower quality coal, and 4% on underground coal. So these guys who try to say, well, they're getting a coal subsidy, they're saying that the underground coal guys are getting a subsidy because they don't have to pay as much tax as the guys doing strip mining.
Yeah.
It's just ridiculous. Obviously, the fossil fuel industry is a huge taxpayer, not a huge absorber of subsidies.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing people should understand that the subsidies is probably not the right word to use. I would call it a tax deduction. The government doesn't write them a check.
That's right. Yeah. And however, the wind energy, the government does write them a check.
Well, yeah. I guess in that part, you're right. Yeah. So let's talk about the wholesale electricity area, because one of the fears that people have is if somebody were to detonate a aerial nuclear device over our electronic grid, we'd be kind of dead in the water. But how is the wholesale cost the cost of wholesale electricity, how's that determined?
Well, in most places it's an auction process.
And it's that way here in Montana as
yeah.
well.
Yeah. The different producers bid on what there's willing to provide electricity at, and then everyone is paid whatever the last person in line who bids the highest price that is actually used. So usually the wind energy guys bid zero because they want all their power to be taken, and maybe the more expensive guys might be some kind of a old coal plant that they only fire up once in a while if the price goes high.
Or maybe somebody with a lot of coal on their property.
Yeah. So that's how it's done. And of course, people try to game the system in one way or another.
Yeah.
The wind energy guys, when they try to pay people to take the electricity, they put a negative value in for the price that they're willing to sell it at.
Well, our coal mines, of course, we had one of our legislators is concerned about the number of trains that go through and the noise they make every time they hit a crossing from all the coal trains that go through Montana. But they employ a lot of people in that, in that industry here in the state.
Sure. I mean, that whole Powder River Basin, that goes into Montana, right?
And that's a
wonderful natural resource that we have.
Now, the wind power, they also have a production tax credit, do they not?
Yes, 2.3 cents a kilowatt hour.
So about 22 bucks for every for every hour they produce. So, wow. Sounds like a good deal. I'm going to go put my windmill up as soon as I get off the air. So,
well, of course, that won't cover their whole cost.
They also sell the electricity
and get whatever they can get in addition to that 2.3 cents.
Yeah. Well, there's got to be a poverty program to donate a windmill to me.
I'm not sure they're making money so well these days because natural gas has become so cheap.
Well, and we've got plenty of that up here too. We've got plenty of natural gas. We've got a lot of coal, and of course we've got a lot of oil. One of our problems is, as you and I talked about off the air, that we're in the Ninth Circuit. Environmentalists are, I think they vacation with these three judges over there.
And, maybe we could petition the Congress to be moved into a different circuit.
Well, boy, I'd like that, because North and South Dakota and Wyoming are there in the 8th District, I believe, and they drill and do everything over there, and they're the poster child for deficit reduction across the country over there. They're having quite a boom, and it looks like it's going to be bigger because I think the Bakken oil fields were now are twice as big as they were, and the natural gas they're going to be taking out of there is going to be quite a bit. So, do you see us getting off of foreign oil? Do we need to have some foreign oil just to keep a good relationship with obviously Canada and Mexico? We want to stay on the good side of them, but we'll have to leave that question for another time. Do you want to hang on for a little while?
Sure, be happy to.
Can you do that? Okay. Well, let's talk about that when we come back. I really appreciate you taking the time out. We're going to have about a 6 or 7 minute break here. News at the top of the hour and all of that. We're talking with Norm Rogers from the Heritage. Or not Heritage, Heartland. I knew I was going to make that mistake somewhere along the line. But we'll be back chatting more with him about alternative fuels and stuff like that. So hang in there. This is News Radio. I am 1450 KMMS in Bozeman, 1340 KPRK in Livingston, and on the World Wide Web at Fine Computers Around the World Everywhere, KMMSAM.com. So we'll put Norm back on hold, and we'll be back with one more hour of Open for Business right after this.
Welcome to Open for Business, the Gallatin Valley's only local business and consumer talk show featuring Tom Eaglehoff, the Man Entrepreneur magazine radio called the leading authority in the United States for doing business in small towns. Here he is, speaker, author, small business consultant, and Mrs. Eaglehoff's favorite son, Tom Eaglehoff.
All right, thank you, Dan. 72 degrees outside, May the 11th, the day before Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day to all you great moms out there. Also, coming up on May 14th, I will be in Livingston from 9 to about 11:30. I'm going to be at the Yellowstone Western Inn over there, Best Western Inn. And I'm going to be talking about how good customer service can hurt your business. So check with the Chamber of Commerce. Give the Chamber of Commerce a call. They are reserving all the seats and everything over there, so give them a call Monday morning. You can still get in. I think there's still room left in the room they've set up for me, so by all means, come over there. It's $25, but you get a free copy of my 260-page book, The Small Town Advertising Handbook, How to Say More and Spend Less. So show up over there. And love to meet everybody from Livingston, and always enjoy the opportunity to get over there. We've asked Norm Rogers to stay around with us. He is a physicist, a retired computer entrepreneur, a volunteer senior policy advisor at the Heartland Institute. He's a member of the American Geophysical Union and the American Meteorological Society. And his website is climateviews.com. So, Norm, thanks for hanging around.
Happy to be here.
Yeah. Where do you see us going with energy? Because that's what this is all about. We either have a recession or a boom centered around energy. A lot of people used to think it was around housing, but I truly believe, and I think Larry Stanzel, who follows me, also agrees that we're looking at energy as being the future production or the future income generator of the world.
Well, it's terribly important for our country, with the fracking and the oil sands in Canada, we have so many possibilities in North America that we should be concentrating that. Unfortunately, we have this environmental lobby, which is just trying to throw a monkey wrench into everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, we've kind of chatted about that a little bit, but the, you know, we've heard all kinds of arguments about the Keystone Pipeline. You know, it would damage the aquifer in Nebraska, and I think they've moved it now to where it's going to go through a different part of Nebraska or whatever. And that the oil isn't going to us. It's we're going to pump it down to, you know, the Gulf Coast, and it's going to end up in Canada or China or whoever. And so there's no question there is a lot of resistance to maintaining the status quo, but don't people realize there's an evolutionary process to these alternative fuels eventually coming to fruition?
Well, I'm not sure that let's go to the Keystone Pipeline first. Sure. Of all, you know, they're saying it's going to hurt the aquifer. Mm-hmm. It's just so ridiculous. The whole country's covered with pipelines. Pipelines are mature technology. We have them every place. The real motive for the people who are opposing this pipeline is global warming, because mm-hmm. they don't like fossil fuels. They don't like fossil fuels at all, and they especially don't like the oil sands. Mm-hmm. And now, if we don't approve that Keystone Pipeline, I had a conversation with a diplomat from Canada about this. If we don't approve it and that oil doesn't go to Texas, they're going to build a pipeline either to their east or west coast and just sell that oil into the world market. And then we'll be buying it through a circuitous route. It'll be coming into tankers in Montreal or Vancouver and coming around down to Louisiana. And then if the price goes up, they can send that oil to Europe or Japan or any place else. If it's coming by pipeline, it's more or less captive. That they really won't have any other place to sell it if there is a crisis. So it's just,
well, China's just across the pond from Vancouver, obviously, and they need there's no way they're getting off of fossil fuels anytime soon.
Yeah, no, and neither are we.
Yeah,
no one's getting off fossil fuels anytime soon.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that people forget is that, you know, we always talk about the emission from gasoline into the atmosphere, but we also use oil for building roads and shingles on houses and tar on rooftops and almost every plastic thing
clothing.
You know, the whole nine yards. We're not going to get away from this, and that's why I sometimes I don't agree with Vinny on a lot of things, but I do agree that I think oil is somehow a naturally occurring substance. Now, whether it's, you know, from dinosaurs and we're eventually going to run out of it, I don't know. But there sure seems to be a lot of it in places where dinosaurs shouldn't have been. You know, and I realize the land masses have shifted around over the millions of years, but I still am a little, I would like to err on on the side of, yeah, let's make it renewable.
Well, you know, the renewable stuff that they're proposing, for instance, ethanol is one, where right now we're turning a good part of the corn crop into alcohol.
Yeah.
And burning it up in cars. Mm-hmm. It drives up the price of gasoline. It drives up the price of corn. It drives up the price of meat. It's and here's the kicker. After they studied it more, they realized it didn't help global warming at all, even if you believe CO2 causes a global warming.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think they wanted to move from, one of the things about ethanol was just to reduce our dependency on foreign oil. I think was how it was sold in the first place.
I know, but it doesn't, because they
it was sold that way, but
yeah.
But yeah, it doesn't. And yeah. Bob and I have bandied that about from time to time, that it's harder on your engine. You can't send it through a pipeline like you can gas. It's too corrosive. You got to have a separate tank at gas stations to offer it. So there's a lot of negative there on that one.
But I'll tell you, the farmers in Idaho and Iowa love it.
Well, I bet. Yeah. Grow that corn, man. Let's go back to the phones. 522-TALK is the number. Caller, you're on the air with Norm Rogers. What's your name? What's up?
Hi, Norm. Hi, Tom. It's Wolf. How you doing?
Hey, Wolf. How are you?
Pretty good. Got a couple simple questions for you. We have natural gas and propane coming out the rear end in this country. Pardon the pun. But we do. We have an excess of that. We know automobiles will run on it. So why haven't they started using that? One of the cleanest burning fuels in the world. And second question, Tom, I need you to do a little math for me.
Okay.
How many billions of dinosaurs would it take to make the amount of fuel we have used already?
How many dinosaurs does it take to make 42 gallon barrel of oil?
Yeah, that's about
okay.
Right.
I'm on that, Wolf. I'm right on it.
Yeah, right on it. See, the point that there's no way there could have been enough earth space to cover to feed the amount of dinosaurs that we would need to have produced the oil that we have already used. There is more to this. I mean, the Russians have been introducing microbes down into so quote unquote dead wells or played out wells, ejecting it with water, and 10 years later, guess what? They got fuel back down in those holes. So there's something going on here. The dinosaur theory don't fly.
Well, let me answer your question about the propane.
Sure.
And
thanks
natural
for the call.
Gas.
Yeah.
All right. Take care.
I think you're right about natural gas. I think propane is a premium fuel, and it's maybe a little bit expensive.
And a lot of the government vehicles, like the Postal Service, is looking into converting theirs over to natural gas, I believe.
Natural gas, you can buy a car right now from Honda that runs on natural gas. Natural gas, compressed natural gas, can be used as a fuel for cars. A lot of, like, electric companies, bus companies use it. The problem with it right now is the infrastructure, the refueling stations don't exist. The only refueling stations are places like electric company lots or bus terminals and so forth. Mm-hmm. But if we got the infrastructure going where you could refuel the car, people could convert to natural gas, and it's much, much cheaper than gasoline.
Yeah. Well, I can see AAA buying a series of balloons, mixing the natural gas with helium, and coming out to refill your car by balloon. So maybe they'll...
I don't think so.
Wait, you don't buy that, Norm? What's wrong with you? I'm a visionary.
but yeah, that would be one way to certainly reduce our... A lot of trucks are being converted to natural gas right now because they can have refueling at truck stops.
Exactly. Yeah, and you're going to have more. That would be less, obviously. The gas is considerably less to produce and get to market than oil for that part of it. And it's going to burn
cleaner.
There's
another thing that can be done, too. Natural gas can be converted into oil.
Yeah.
And there's a plant in Qatar right now in the Persian Gulf, cost $19 billion, called the Pearl Plant. And that's producing around 200,000 barrels a day of liquid fuels from natural gas.
Well, the other thing we were talking about, all the pipelines that crisscross the country. Some of those are, you know, they used to be iron pipes, and they're no longer safe to put oil through, but they're sticking PVC through them and shipping natural gas that way.
Is that right?
Through some of these antiquated lines, they're just putting a piece of PVC inside them and shipping gas through old pipelines or old oil pipelines.
Mm-hmm.
So
and certainly natural gas is a wonderful fuel. Wonderful for home heating. It's very clean burning. It's also a good fuel for cars, except for the fact that you need to have some fairly large tanks, high strength tanks.
Yeah, it's not gonna, it isn't gonna take you the distance that a tank of gas normally would at 20
That's right.
or 25 or 30 miles to the gallon. So you'd need to refuel more often, but if the refueling was as plentiful as gas stations, you'd be in pretty good shape unless you're in the middle of Montana somewhere. But I guess you carry a trailer behind you with
and if you have some of the more modern cars that get 50 miles per gallon, then you really would be able to go as far as you can now with a typical car.
Why don't they do the hybrids with natural gas and internal combustion, where they're doing the hybrids with electricity and whatever? Is it strictly the size of the storage of the tanks?
I think it's the what's keeping the natural gas from cars from taking off is the refueling infrastructure.
Yeah, because you'd have to have though. I mean, electricity is everywhere. You can plug your car in probably anywhere. But,
well, electric cars are not practical. Okay,
no, they're not.
It takes a couple hours to recharge the car, and the batteries are extremely expensive, and the batteries
and hard to recycle.
Well, you can torch them maybe. But,
well, yeah. we'll burn them like with a tire, so the other guy will.
But you may have to replace the batteries frequently, every 20,000-30,000 miles, and it may cost $10,000 to replace the batteries.
Yeah. Well, of course,
electric car.
Yeah. Well, of course, in Montana here, where we have 10 months of snow and 2 months of soggy sledding, you got to use that heater and defroster and the whole nine yards here a good part of the year. So,
and that's going to run your battery down even faster.
Yes, it will. Let's go to the phones. Caller, you are on the air. 522 Talk is the number.
It's Wolf again. Yeah. You made a great statement there about using the propane and fuel. Now, there are companies that use, or natural gas, there are companies that convert diesels into propane as a booster. Okay. Why not have a small diesel engine run electric generators, and that way you have a diesel electric car, much like your big locomotives. Now, we know the locomotives are fuel efficient.
Yeah.
The German diesel electrics are efficient. Why not do the best of both worlds and boost it with a little, natural gas or propane and stick the diesel in it? I mean, I understand about the fueling stations, but man, wouldn't that make sense?
Well, I think you're just talking about a hybrid car with a diesel engine.
Basically, the German, it's not the Passat, but the Golf. They still make the Golf, I believe. And it's a diesel electric. It's got a little three-cylinder diesel engine. It gets like 85 miles per gallon. At that point in time, if you only had a 10-gallon fuel tank, who cares?
Did you get
850 miles out of your tank, a car?
There's a lot of room for improvement of the automobiles and the internal combustion engine.
And that makes you
probably it's a matter of cost.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that makes you beg to wonder why the environmentalists don't go back and go, wait a minute, why aren't we all over this instead of making lithium batteries that, have a potential for hazard and fire and yada, 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 Anyway, mm-hmm. I'll let you keep
all
talking.
Right. Yeah, thanks a lot.
Bye.
Well, and I think the environmentalists, they want it to happen right now. And, I'm sure if Henry Ford asked people what they wanted back in 1900, they would have told him, we want bigger, stronger horses. But, that's not necessarily what is best for everybody.
I don't say this lightly. I think the environmentalists are largely crackpots.
Well, I think their heart's in the right place. Having moved here from Southern California and driving home and seeing a brown layer on the horizon, that's not a healthy environment.
Yeah, well, I'm in favor of old-fashioned environmentalism.
Sure.
I mean, the kind of environmentalism that, keeps the air clear and, keeps the rivers and lakes unpolluted. I'm in favor of that.
Yeah.
But it's morphed into something far more radical.
Yeah. Well, what the environmentalists don't think of, or maybe they do think of it, or they're just because they went through a whole different growth process, is that anything that does something for you, there has to be a profit in producing that thing to do that for you. And that's the problem with the environmentalists. They say, well, if we could pass a law to take all the fossil fuel trucks and cars off the road, and there was a 5-year plan to replace them. And you pointed out earlier about the, these laws that, we want to by 2025 or 2050 or something like that. We want to reduce this by that or whatever. And, that's what we're kind of up against. And they say, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's make that happen. Let's make it happen.
Well, another thing you have to think about, these big environmental organizations like the Sierra Club, Nature Conservancy, Audubon Society, Environmental Defense Fund, these are organizations with budgets and payrolls.
Sure.
And they kind of traffic that. Their product is scarce. They try to scare people and make it. There's something really bad going on. That's the way they get people to give contributions and to join up. So they have to always have a new scare. And if you go back in the 70s, the scares were DDT or dioxin, nuclear power. Then they switched to global warming, and now their latest scare is climate change. And another scare they're coming up with is acidification of the oceans. So they always have to have a new scare.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was interesting, and we talked about this earlier in the first hour, I believe, that global warming became kind of a catchword, and then it was changed to climate change rather than global warming, because that didn't always fit when it was snowing 6 feet or You know, it was 20 below zero because the joke would be here in Montana. So much for that global warming, you know, when you're out there scraping your windshield. You know, where's the 70 degree weather I was supposed to have on Christmas Day?
Yeah, exactly. extreme weather is a great one because, you know, we always think that today's bad weather is the worst we've ever seen because we kind of, the bad memory we had 10 years ago sort of fades away in our memories, you know, so it always works.
Well, that's another thing that you know, is easy to say that when you have more hurricanes than average, and you know, some years are like that, some years they're less than average.
Yeah, but we've had less hurricanes than average for a very long period with no Category 3 hurricanes coming into the continental United States.
Yeah, and global melting of the ice caps and all of those things, you know, that are all kind of cherry picked. You know, they sometimes we cherry pick a period of time that fits our agenda.
Yeah.
Or we'll pick a part of the country that promotes what we think.
Yeah, or take a short-term trend that's been going on for a few years and project it 1,000 years in the future and say, "Oh, there's a disaster coming."
Where do you see the future of energy? What's your pet project? I guess if you were in charge of eliminating fossil fuel or replacing it with something else, what's your
what I worry about the most is that there's a lot of geopolitical forces in the world that could cause a sudden shortage of oil. For instance, Iran is armed to the teeth with the objective of being able to close off the Persian Gulf.
Right.
And that would cut off 20% of the world's oil, which would make the price go from $100 a barrel to $300 a barrel.
Yeah.
And we'd be wise to try to be North American independent and not be importing all that oil from places like Venezuela or Africa and so forth. And the beneficial effect of that would be that the Japanese and the Europeans and the other people who are importing this oil would have to step up to be policemen of all this oil. We could maybe relax a little bit and not have to always be in charge of protecting the oil supply for the whole world.
Well, that's true, too. Well, and the other thing, too, is we are obviously the biggest oil user on the planet by far, I would say.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that's going to... these other countries are going to be in a bidding war for, you know, whatever we don't need. And OPEC is, you know, if we cut off us from them, that would be a significant drain in their prosperity.
Yeah, it would lower the price of oil worldwide, probably would help the whole world's economy, except for the OPEC guys, and who cares about them?
I would agree. So, you know, that leaves Russia and Iran and Iraq and a couple others.
Our great friends, the Russians, the Iraqis, the Iranians.
Invite them to the party, man. They, yeah. I'd like to see a war between them. Norm, it's been a great hour and a half. Thanks so much for spending some extra time with us. We really appreciate you taking the time. I got to have you back on again, so we'll be in touch, and maybe we'll get you back here as more global warming stuff comes to the.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're great. Yeah, great. Thanks for talking to you. Okay. All right, we'll see you later. Thank you. Bye bye. All right. Well, Larry Stanzel's in the house. We'll maybe keep this chat going, or anything else you want to talk about. Have a half hour of open lines. So stick around, and we'll have a little fun here as we move into the move up toward the 2 o'clock hour of Open for Business. This is News Radio, AM 1450, KMMS in Bozeman, 1340, KPRK in Livingston, and the World Wide Web everywhere, KMMSAM.com. Don't forget, May 14th, Tuesday morning, 9 to 1130, I'll be at the Best Western Yellowstone Inn. Call the Livingston Chamber.